Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 19th of June. Our guest wrote in the Christian Science Monitor on Monday of this week, "The Greek electorate held its nose and voted for reform and austerity for Europe and the euro. It was a vote based largely on the fear of the alternative, not exactly a confidence-inspiring motive, but at least it produced a workable result that Greece's creditors should support." This hour of the program, we'll be talking about what happened in Greece on Sunday, where the New Democracy Party won 30% of the vote. And as you heard during the news from NPR, Greeks are in day two of party-sharing talks. Our guest is Professor Thomas Klein Brokoff. He's a resident fellow and senior director for strategy at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. He's been an expert on transatlantic relations for more than a decade, and he also, before he arrived at the GMF, served as the Washington Bureau Chief of Die Zeit, Germany's intellectual weekly. He was educated in Germany and with additional schooling at Georgetown School of Business. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I know there's a lot of interest in this topic. Every time we talk about Greece or what's going on in Europe, our phone lines are flooded. So feel free to join the conversation. And the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook thing is The Kathleen Dunn Show, so you got all kinds of places where you can leave messages. Thomas Klein Brokoff, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. You wrote that, we can almost imagine these people, the Greeks, going into the polling booth and standing there and going, all right, holding their nose and voting for reform. Not a lot of enthusiasm in this election. What were they voting for?
You can just imagine a Greek voter, the terrible choice a voter had. There was the two parties that ran the country alternatingly for several decades that had turned it into a clientelistic state, that had given everything to everybody. Even during the first phase after the crash in 2008, in the first reform phase, they tried to protect their own clientele. And it was only the alternative of a left-wing utopianism and populism that promised to stay in Europe but do not abide by the conditionality that the international creditors had demanded of Greece, sort of an unrealistic alternative that brought Greece to vote for the classical long-standing parties that promised to reform themselves and the country at the same time.
Mm-hmm. The news, NPR News, ended the newscast by talking about this being day two of the party-sharing talks that are going on. Who's involved in those talks and who's going to share with whom?
It's the New Democracy, the center-right party that won the election with nearly 30% of the vote, looking for a centrist coalition. And at first, they're looking at PASOK, the center-left party. Those are the two that I talked about having run the country for decades. Now, with the collapse of the center-left, PASOK is no more than in the teens of the electorate's favor, but both together will be able to master a majority, and their rivalry over decades is now in the way of forming a government. Mm. But it seems that can be overcome.
It seems it can be, or it definitely will be. Is there a chance that it may not be overcome?
Oh, there is some strong characters at play. The two leaders of the two parties are known for their personal rivalry, and they have clashed with each other before. But these are extraordinary times in the course of the technocratic government that Greece had leading up to this election. They cooperated, so they might have found a way to cooperate on the agenda of turning the corner for Greece and moving forward with reforms, that could be an agenda that they could agree for some time to come.
Thomas, what happened to the Greek economy?
Well, the Greek economy, it depends on how far you want to go back. Certainly with the euro, with the entrance into the eurozone in 1999, Greece had an enormous boost. From one day to the next, interest rates fell to unprecedented level because the markets essentially saw the European Union as the eurozone as one and priced debt at German rates. Now, that was unrealistic, as we've seen, but Greece benefited from it, and rather than investing it into the productive part of the economy, it was largely spent either on consumption or on bloating the government sector, which now has created a huge bureaucracy of unproductive bureaucrats.
And tell me more about that. Describe that bloated government bureaucracy. They have people who are doing unnecessary jobs, or what?
Yes, I mean there's I don't know the exact percentage of the working population employed in the public sector, but it is way above the European average, and at the same time, their salaries nearly doubled over the time that Greece has had the euro. So there is, and not only the public sector, but also the private sector's wages went way up above the European average, and certainly above the German average that held wages pretty much stable over the last decade. That resulted in a huge competitive disadvantage of Greece, which in turn resulted in a current account deficit, importing much more than Greece was able to export. And even in those areas of the economy where Greece had competitive advantages, from shipping to tourism, a lack of investment and competitiveness held Greece back over this last decade. And then here comes the financial crisis, the crash. That is the moment the Greek malaise started to be evident to the markets, and then the markets corrected their mispricing of risk.
So could you say that joining with the European Union was an enormous problem for the Greeks? It was a boost, but it was also problematic and perhaps should not have happened?
I think a lot of people agree today that from a European Union standpoint, not so much from a Greek standpoint, having Greece join the common currency was a mistake. And that mistake was, from a European perspective, the difference in productivity levels between Greece and other countries in the eurozone, because you can only sustain a common currency zone, especially one where you don't have where you build a car and don't have a driver, a central authority that decides whether you take a left turn or a right turn. You need convergence and you need policy coordination, and that is increasingly hard if the economic fates of countries within the currency zone diverge in the way Greece and some of the northern countries have been diverging.
Mm-hmm. So if everything works out with these party talks, then what happens to Greece? They're immediately rescued?
No. We already had a debt write-down in the past. You are seeing some of the reforms that have been enacted to built the basis for a long-term growth of the Greek economy. Some of them are already paying dividends. The current account deficit is shrinking, but it is also shrinking because of the lack of demand and the recession in Greece. So it's partially because of recession, partially because of reform. And there is a clear roadmap that the international investors, the IMF, the European Central Bank, the European Commission have agreed on with Greece that includes further reform steps in order to open up the economy. A lot of professions are closed professions. The healthcare sector is in huge disarray. Young people are excluded from the labor market, and therefore, in countries in Greece, there's a huge youth unemployment rate. In order to correct these things, the agenda is pretty much set by an agreement between the previous Greek governments and the international investors.
Well, that's interesting. What is the unemployment rate in Greece right now? Is it very high?
It is extremely high, and it still keeps growing. It depends on the region and the profession, but we're in some areas talking about 20 to 25%, and the youth unemployment can even be higher in some areas because of the fact that some professions are protected, and it's very hard for especially young people. Market entrance is a problem if you have protection on the other side.
You wrote in a piece recently, I'm not sure where it appeared, one day you say when historians look back to June 2012, they will likely find it was a make or break month for Europe. That's a pretty dramatic statement.
When you look at the current situation is not to be underestimated. I think the markets are seem to be concluding that the European Union is at a watershed moment in which it only has two choices: integrate or disintegrate, fall apart, or put itself on the road to political union and federalization.
Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the results of the Greek election on Sunday. The New Democracy Party won 30% of the vote, and it may allow the party to form a governing coalition that will keep Greece in the European Union. The talks are going on now, day two of the party sharing talks, and we're looking at so many issues that are front and center as a result of these elections, and how Greece came to this point, and what's happening with the euro, and what's happening with the European Union, and as our guest said, how this may be really a make or break time for the union and for Europe. To your phone calls, Brian is our first caller. Hi, Brian.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen. Good, sir. I'd like to just my comment and subsequent question on the premise that history is full so diligently because past is the best predictor of the future. And the past shows us that in a capitalist economy, we have to spend money. We have to move currency in order to grow. And unfortunately, Greece is a microcosmic global economic situation. What's happened in Greece is that they are under the auspice of German financiers and American financiers, the super hoarded cash. They've been doing so since before the 2008 debacle. And as a result, we're seeing a significant depression globally. And wouldn't you agree, sir, the solution is to help the rich spend money. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Talking about the rich is a big issue in Greece because the country has been run, dominated by a small group of families that have amassed enormous riches, and the oligarchic structure of the society is one of the problems of Greece that has to be corrected and is on the way of being corrected. fact that their tax evasion there has been a national sport. But I think to the broader point that you cannot your point is about austerity and growth, if I understand it correctly, that you have to have investment and have to spend money in order not to be in a deflationary and depressionary cycle. That, of course, is correct. The question, however, is if you are in a country that is cut off from the financial market, that has a huge deficit, there is no money to spend and no money for you to borrow and no money for you to invest. The question then becomes, where does that money come from? And the first rescue here is Europe. The European Union has been looking to move money into Greece. The European Investment Bank is looking at that. But to what I understand, Greece fulfills none of the accountability criteria that would allow European institutions to spend their taxpayer money on projects in Greece. They also have problem identifying these types of projects. So I think the question that we're looking at is, are we looking at failed austerity or are we looking at a failed state, and how do you get out of that cycle in order, as the caller says, as Brian says, how do you move money into the country in order to invest?
And what would be the accountability criteria?
There's a whole set of accountability criteria of how European so-called structural funds can be spent and what type of transparency and accountability rules need to be followed. Mm. Remember, this is a country that does not have a full register of deeds so that real estate and property is registered properly throughout the nation. That makes it very hard, and there are multiple of these administrative hurdles where you would say a modern industrialized country would universally have these features, but not so in Greece, which makes it very hard for the European money, European Union to move investment and even the help that that people agree that Greeks deserve and need at this point.
Hmm. At what point it would seem to me as though there must be a lot of country to country tensions here, and some people saying, I wonder if all of this is worth it. Maybe we should go back to when Greece was Greece and Germany was Germany and Spain was Spain, and we'll take care of our own business. Thank you.
Yes, that's certainly the case, that this crisis has brought out the worst certainly in Greek-German relations, because you can see the opposite poles in this debate are between some Greeks and some Germans. The Germans are seen as the disciplinarians here that mm-hmm. put undue austerity onto Greece, and the Germans wonder why they have done all these liberalization, market reform, have raised the pension age to 67 while you can retire in Greece much earlier. So the question is being asked, why should we support the Greeks if they don't want to do the hard work of reform? So you have nationalist tendencies in several countries. That is part of the tension that comes along with this very hard restructuring process that is now underway.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Brian, for your call. We go to Jim in Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling to ask if the guest would like to further comment on what's now an established fact that New York-based Goldman Sachs introduced information to the Greek officials how to falsify their books so they could enter the Eurozone. And if that isn't enough, they sold the resulting bonds to their own customers while at the same time shorting or selling the value of those bonds, realizing it was just a question of time before the value of those bonds would collapse.
I've read this. It's a little hard for me to comment on it because I don't know the facts beyond what has been out in the newspapers. But what I can say is, of course, that the entrance into the European currency zone has been a disaster when looking at the Greek case. Everybody wanted Greece in and closed their eyes to the obvious falsifications that were the fabrications that were constructed in order for Greece to get in. The European Union was and the Eurozone was used as an ATM, as a cash machine, or as a cow that you could milk, and everybody's paying the price for that behavior. Now, which, by the way, governs some of the responses in the northern creditor countries, where people and politicians say that solutions that eliminate moral hazard are non-solutions because they're just repeating the mistakes of the past. So market structures have to be in place, and the market should be the institution that punishes behavior like that.
Thank you, Jim, very much for the call. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the election in Greece and more broadly about what's going on financially in Europe. Greek elections sparking our conversation today because they took place on Sunday with the New Democracy Party winning 30% of the vote in Greece. But there are talks going on now. They're in their second day of talks of putting together the center-right New Democracy Party and another party. The 30% of the vote went to the center-right Democracy Party, and the anti-bailout, anti-German and nationalist, what has been described as a left-wing utopian group, came in not far behind, so you can imagine the political divisions in Greece with 27% of the vote. And, you know, then you have to ask the question, this is kind of where it becomes really complicated, is how all of this affects the U.S. markets, and we'll try to delve into that as we carry on here this hour. Our guest is Thomas Klein Brokhoff. He leads the Euro Future Project at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A line is open for you right now if you'd like to join us. You can also send an email message at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and leave a message. That's at the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Dwight in Delavan is our next caller. Hi, Dwight.
Hello. Appreciate your program today. Very important topic. I have a question for your guest. What does he think about Angela Merkel's sort of not being strong enough to get a political fiscal union deal done in the existing Eurozone, and what kind of consequence or is going to happen shortly in the German elections, and how that's going to affect what's going on over there? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dwight.
Angela Merkel is seen as the only person that really can move the needle in Europe, at least when looking from the United States. But I think that in this country, German power at this stage is overestimated. Germany is only 27% of the Eurozone's output. It cannot be the anchor of the bailout of economies that, when you put Spain and Italy together, that equals the size of Germany. Historically, the Germans are very averse to taking on this type of leadership role. This is, of course, not only a legacy of the Second World War, but ever since industrialization, Germany has been too big in Europe to be one of many, and too small to dominate the continent. And so Germans are very averse to the idea, even if it's a some sort of benevolent hegemony in which the neighbors consent to German leadership, and if that leadership is accompanied by transfer of wealth. So there's a leadership question, and then there is a size question. Given those constraints, in my view, Angela Merkel has shown leadership and has adopted and found a strategy to exert leadership even under those limitations. Now, as the caller says, what happens if nothing happens, if there's no fiscal union, if there's no political union, if there's no road towards those are defined, then we will indeed see the disintegration of the post-war European order. But this is not in Germany's interest. It has been the only European order that has guaranteed affluence and peace at the same time for the central power in Germany. So I think what we're seeing is the careful attempt to find consensus or majority in Europe towards a roadmap to what I would call a core federalism, a centralization of power, at least in the financial and fiscal sector, as the roadmap for the next couple of years.
And because we're concerned about what's happening to our money here in the United States, please tell me, and I know it's not a little question, but how in the world all of this is affecting the United States, big investors in the United States, and small investors?
It certainly is affecting the United States, and that is because of a phenomenon that I would call deep integration. The markets and the economies on both sides of the Atlantic are deeply integrated. Multinational companies have a foothold, they have production sites on both sides of the Atlantic, inside the Eurozone as inside the United States. So a recession in Europe has multiple ripple effects. You're already seeing the European recession affecting and slowing growth in China, and you're seeing the European situation affecting the growth numbers in the United States. And the most important factor here is confidence, that the confidence of the markets in growth and in increased growth is waning, and that is, I think, what we're seeing. One needs to keep in mind that the combination of the U.S. and the European Union is still 40% of world trade and output. That the foreign direct investment of the United States in the Republic of Ireland, population 4 million, is bigger than in the Republic of China.
Oh my! Really?
3 billion. Huh. Well, that's because that may be an odd number, and it is misleading in one way, because of course Ireland is the location of all U.S. corporate giants, because it's English speaking and it's inside the Eurozone, so it's an airport carrier for business in the Eurozone for the United States. But it does show that even in a small country, how enormous the stakes are that the United States has in the success of the Eurozone.
Right. Let's go next to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. So, to try to put this in layman's terms, so in a nutshell, and let's say from the Germans' perspective, they're looking at a series of countries that have overspent, have huge entitlements, which nobody paid their taxes, and that is indicating a way of life, a way of doing things. So if they bail them out, what guarantee is it that you know, by some miracle, they're going to change their way of doing things and everything's going to be hunky-dory? In other words, they'll get bailed out, and in a very short period of time, they're going to fall back into the same thing. So, you know, from the Germans' perspective, I totally understand their reluctance.
But the Germans have great entitlements too, Mike.
Yeah, but they're highly productive. They pay their taxes, you know. Just a different focus.
Are entitlements central to these problems, Thomas?
Yes, they are. They are in Italy, where you have a pension reform underway, they are in Greece with the retirement age. And the advantage of Germany in this case is that they've had their entitlement and structural reforms a few years back, which they're benefiting from now. But where I agree with the assessment of the caller is that bailouts alone cannot do the trick, because, as he said, without structural reforms, there'll be a repetition.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the sequencing of events from a German perspective is important. In some federal structure, eventually, you will have mutualization of debt, that Europeans share the risk of debt. But in order to be able to do that, from a German standpoint, structural reforms have to be in place in the adjustment countries in order not to repeat these same behaviors, and to have control mechanisms in place, budget control mechanism and structural reform mechanisms, in order for the Germans to agree to the mutualization of debt and risk sharing in Europe. So the sequence is not secondary from a northern creditor nation standpoint in order to address the problem that your caller outlined.
And what were the entitlement reforms that the Germans took on a few years ago that have served them well?
These were mostly reforms of opening up the labor market. That was one element, and the second element was pension reform.
I see. Thank you, Mike, very much for your call. Let's go to Bob in Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Could you comment on why some countries want to be in the EU but not on the euro? For example, I think Bulgaria, Greece's neighbor to the north, is in that situation. Thank you, and I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, Bob.
Yes, there are a number of countries that do want to be in the EU and don't want to be in the currency zone. That applies most prominently to Great Britain, but it also applies to Denmark, to Sweden. And as the caller says, it applies to several of the new accession countries in Central and Eastern Europe, most prominently among them Poland. Some of these countries, as Poland and Latvia, are countries that are not yet in the Eurozone and aspire to be in the Eurozone. Others, like the Czech Republic, don't aspire to be in the Eurozone. That is a matter of national preference. The Danes, for example, have had a referendum on this years back. They decided not to be in the Eurozone, but they have introduced a peg to the euro that connects the exchange rate of their currency to the euro. Of course, the reason behind that is a phenomenon that we know well since 1648. It's called national sovereignty. What the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, Osborne, has called the remorseless logic of the currency zone is that you will have to hand over sovereignty to the entity that is governing the Eurozone. And if you don't do that, you're run into a crisis like the one that we're in now.
Hmm. Could we pay just a little bit of attention to other countries that keep coming into the news and then they leave for a while? Spain being one of the countries that's been mentioned as having significant financial problems right now and in need of help. Can you explain what's going on in Spain?
I'll try.
Okay.
it starts with a late industrialization. Spain has emerged from dictatorship late in the 1970s and was a late entry to the European Union and an early entry into the Eurozone. So they've been catching up tremendously, and they've benefited tremendously first from the entry into the European Union, then into the Eurozone. We have seen an investment boom and most prominently a real estate boom in the 90s and especially the 2000s. So Spain is the most similar country in terms of the nature of the crises to the U.S., in fact, because it's at the heart a real estate boom gone bust and loans gone bust, and a banking system that has gone bust and belly up because of a real estate boom and declining home values. Therefore, the Spanish crisis is different from the Italian and the Greek crisis. The Spanish government is not bloated. It is actually a fairly lean government. It is working well, and it has had a low debt-to-GDP ratio going into the crisis. However, when it needed to nationalize banks, when it needed to bail out banks, all of a sudden that number shot up tremendously because of the bank bailouts. Now they're in a situation that the real estate prices still haven't found a bottom. They have introduced the same type of supply-side structural reform that Italy and others and Portugal and Ireland have introduced to open up the markets and stimulate growth in the long term. But, of course, in the short term, that means a lot of pain and a recessionary cycle. Now we're in the second phase of the banking bust, with the real estate prices still not having bottomed out, and it is still unclear what actually is worth anything on the books of several groups of Spanish banks, especially the nationalized and unified Cajas, the local banks that are united in a construction called Bankia, which is a collection of such banks and have run into great trouble, and that is at the heart of the current Spanish problem.
And did Spain have budget surpluses before the crisis, and does that contradict with the narrative of entitlements and spending creating the crisis there?
Yes, in Spain, that is a different. It's a different crisis.
Right.
There, also, the German narrative of that this is a debt crisis does not apply because the Spanish debt was lower than the German debt going into this crisis, and it only ballooned by way of the crisis. And as you said, the Spanish state is different from the Greek state.
Right.
This is not a nation of civil servants and a bloated public sector.
Yeah.
Therefore, the nature of their reforms have to be different. What is an issue in Spain is the closed markets. You have a huge youth unemployment ranging up to the 50% at this point.
Oh my.
And the reason for that is that the labor market protections for those who are in the labor market, disadvantaging those who want to get into the labor market, and that is especially young people. Therefore, the Spanish reforms don't target entitlements to the same degree that they do in other countries in Europe, but they target the liberalization of the labor market.
I see. And we'll move to France in a little while, but let's go back to phone calls. Paul in Eau Claire. Hi, Paul.
Yes, hi. Transparency International ranks um, countries in the world. In this case, last year, 2011, it ranked 183 countries based on the perception of corruption throughout the world. And the European countries, relatively speaking, did quite well. Greece ranked 80th, the lowest of the Eurozone. The Nordic countries scored high. Germany came in number 14 in the world with a score of 8.0. Greece had a score of 3.4. My point is that no matter which way you slice things, the underlying point is corruption. And another way of saying this, I think, is something you touched on, is tax and how taxes are paid or not paid. So I'm afraid that this is not always addressed or talked about, and I'm not sure what can be done about changing attitudes.
I entirely agree. The caller points to the magnitude of the cultural change and the reform effort that is needed in this case, mostly in the Greek case. Several phenomena apply to Greece that usually apply to development aid, which is local. You need local buy-in. You need local institutions. You need a tax rate and a lack of tax evasion to some degree to sustain a state. So, which is why I mentioned before the question is, are we seeing a failed state or failed austerity? You need to rebuild the structures of the Greek state, and you need local buy-in to do it. Whether that can be done, and if it can be done, how long it will take, is beyond me to assess. I just know it'll take a long time, and what we'll be seeing is a long-term commitment of the European Union to pave the way for Greece to bear the burden of this adjustment process, as long as the Greeks themselves want to take on that task, which is why this election of last Sunday was so important, to make that determination from a European standpoint, whether or not it is worth supporting Greece for the long term, whether there is enough buy-in for such a reform effort.
Let's spend a little bit more time talking about this issue of tax evasion, which Paul brought up. Is this a widespread problem in Greece? Who's not paying taxes?
It is a widespread problem in Greece. I don't know exactly the numbers, but the rate of intake of taxes is low, very low indeed in Greece. Hmm. But it's not as if all of Southern Europe has that same problem. To some degree, you can find that problem in Italy. Some of the reforms that the Mario Monti government in Italy has introduced try to address the tax evasion problem, but there is a difference of magnitude, an order of magnitude that is different between countries like Italy and Greece.
Paul, thanks so much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. For Thomas Klein Brokoff, who leads the Euro Future Project at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Send an email if you'd like. That's talk@wpr.org, or you can go to the Facebook page of the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're spending this hour talking about the election in Greece on Sunday and the Greek economy and how the European Union is dealing with Greece and how this election will probably allow them to stay in the European Union and whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing and the financial problems that other European countries are facing and how this all affects the United States, and on it goes. So we'll take more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Raj in Madison. Hi, Raj.
You're calling me Raj now?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. One of the issues that I think has not been addressed is the cultural difference and the work ethic. I was recently looking at per capita GDP comparing Greece and Finland. Finland with a population of about 6 million and Greece with a population of about 12 million. And the per capita GDP for Greece is about half of that of Finland. And so it's understandable that the people in Northern Europe would be reluctant, if you will, to support this sort of a thing, the bailout, if you will, of Greece, if they feel that it's primarily because of the lack of productivity. I think there are fundamental cultural differences between the Southern European countries and the Northern European countries. I was wondering whether your guest would comment on that.
Yes, Europe is a divided continent and has been, and the idea of the European Union and what has been framed the European project is to overcome these differences, and it is a gigantic political and cultural project. And part of, so we've had in 1989, we used to talk about Western Europe and Eastern Europe because of the wall and the aftermath of the fall of the wall. It seems that we are overcoming the division between East and West in this crisis, especially because some of the more Eastern European countries are seeing themselves in terms of fiscal values and fiscal and economic policy more aligned with the other northern countries than with other countries in Europe. But the downside of this is that a new dividing line in Europe is emerging that can be very unproductive and unhealthy for this European project, and that is indeed, as you say, the dividing line between North and South, and that is connected with cultural perception, sometimes with prejudice, certainly also with measurable difference, like the one about productivity that the caller mentions. Now, part of the idea of a European Union that is a shared project for the future would be taking on this problem and doing two things. One is to stimulate a reform process in the South to close the gap, and secondly, to enact and live by the principle of solidarity, which allows and gives the southern countries the time to adjust and do that with the help of the northern countries like Finland.
Paul Krugman, in yesterday's column, said that the Greeks work longer hours than almost anyone else in Europe, and much longer hours than the Germans in particular.
That is certainly true, but the question is not hours, but productivity. And there's that's where the difference is between some of the northern countries and Greece, and that's where the makeup process the process will have to start.
Thanks, Raj, for the call. Barbara in Superior. Hi.
Hello. Say, I'm wondering why France is not in the discussion. France is a wealthy country, very high quality of living. Could you please explain why France is rarely mentioned in this discussion? Thank you.
Because France has been part of the solution, not part of the problem so far. But there is problems in France as well. No Western society, and that includes the United States and Canada, is free of structural issues these days. In France, you have a combination of limiting factors. You have a core of very well-positioned, globalized, internationalized companies that export, that do domestic business, that do very good business inside the Eurozone. But that core is not large enough. There is also a smaller productivity gap. France has fallen behind Germany in this respect, and which is why the previous president, Sarkozy, reminded his countrymen that France itself has a reform effort in front of them.
And let's just throw in this, because last time we talked about France, we were talking about the anti-deficit nature of the political debate that resulted in Hollande taking office in France. Is this something that's unusual in Europe, that the socialist won on that platform, or am I reading that wrong?
No. What we are beginning to see, I think, in Europe is a political rebalancing. We have, for a number of years, had the unusual situation that most European countries, most of the larger European countries, were governed from the center right. That has been true in Britain, in France, in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, and the list goes on.
Mm-hmm.
That's unusual. with the election of François Hollande in France, I think we're beginning to see a political rebalancing towards the left. That doesn't necessarily need to happen in all countries at the same time, but if you were to hold elections in, let's say, Italy today, you would probably see a strengthened center-left. So François is the Hollande is the beginning, not the end of a development, and that is quite natural in a time when in a time of less, when there is less less growth, when there is less affluence, when there is less money, people and more unemployment, people look at issues of social justice, especially if there's painful adjustment and reform efforts. They're looking to the center left to provide social justice within this broader effort.
Hmm. Oh, there's so much for you to keep track of, Thomas, isn't there?
I have a 24/7 job these days.
I guess you do. It just takes in so darn much. I thank you very much for being with us this hour. It was very informative.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Our guest this hour, Thomas Klein Brokhoff, who heads the Euro Future Project at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. He is... been an expert on transatlantic relations for a number of years, served as the Washington Bureau Chief for Germany's Intellectual Weekly for a number of years, was educated in Germany, and we thank him for being with us. He was also a fellow at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. You're so sophisticated, and you know so much about so many different issues. It's a pleasure to talk to you every day. So that's it. We have great conversations coming up, so please stay right here. Lots of great talk and conversation and a chance for you to participate in all of that. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.